Blog Talk Radio.
In March 2001.
doesn't make me feel like supporting him.
No, it doesn't at all, actually. And but you know, I wanted to play this because I was impressed that this is what this is Ron Paul's. It's about 15 minutes long, if you don't mind.
Okay.
But it's Ron Paul's speech last night after the after he came in second place. And I also have a little bit of a short one on Democrats. Democrats are abandoning Obama for Ron Paul.
Hmm.
Right? And
well, let's play that
a little
right
bit
now.
On this. So let's listen to his victory speech. Okay, though he came
and
in second
place. And
see
if it matches anything that he said in 2001.
Yeah,
it's
rather, rather interesting.
Here we have a daughter-in-law of Peggy, and we have Lisa, Linda, and Mark. And you know, we have another member of the family, but he's also on the staff. But I think technically in the family, he's a grandson-in-law. That's Jesse Benton. But it is a delight. And Jim, Senator Forsyth, thank you very much for your support, along with Andy, for your co-sponsorship, and Ray. I appreciate all that. That is just great. I do want to mention three names of the individuals who did so much organization up here, and that was Jared Sherkoin as well. Jared, I don't know if he's here. He's probably still making phone calls or something. And Bob Goodman, he's did a tremendous amount of work here. And George Brown, he was fantastic. But there was one other acknowledgement I wanted to make. I wanted to thank the union leader for not endorsing me. I called Governor Romney a short while ago before he gave his talk and congratulate him because he certainly had a clear-cut victory, but we're nibbling at his heels. But there was another victory tonight. He had a victory, but we have had a victory for the cause of liberty tonight. There is no doubt that this whole effort that we are involved in will not go unnoticed, let me tell you. I think the intellectual revolution that's going on now to restore liberty in this country is well on its way, and there's no way they're going to stop the momentum that we have started. Victory that you have brought about because you have been the ones that have done the work. There's a lot of people here, but the ones across the countries, the donors, and the excitement on the campuses, it's just unbelievable. We don't always get the coverage or the interest shown on what is going on, because if they did, they wouldn't be ignoring so much of what we're doing. But, you know, I find it sort of fascinating when they finally get around, and this is different people. It could be in the media. It could be our opponents or whatever. But I sort of have to chuckle when they describe you and me as being dangerous. That's one thing, they are telling the truth, because we are dangerous to the status quo in this country. monetary history from the beginning of our country and even throughout all of history, monetary policy on periodic occasions will become the dominant issue. And we have emphasized that, and it has become an important issue. Just think, this is the first presidential campaign that the subject ever came up since the Federal Reserve was started. So we are now, because of what is happening, it will remain a dominant issue. There's no way they're going to put it to bed because they have destroyed our money. It's worldwide. There's a financial crisis going on, and it's only sound money and personal liberty that can solve the crisis that we have today. The one reason I talk about the monetary system so much, it was a sneaky, deceitful way to pay the bills. You know, an honest government that wants to be a big spending government would tax the people, and then the people would know what they were doing. If we had to pay taxes for everything that they do, you know, the people would rise up and stop it. So then they started borrowing money a lot, and then people didn't notice that quite as much because it passed that on. But then they resorted to the printing of the money, and that is why the Federal Reserve was established, to take care of the powerful interests, the military-industrial complex, the banking system, and deficit financing. And there's a couple reasons they have deficit financing. Sometimes there are conservatives that want deficit financing, and sometimes there are liberals who want deficit financing. And they have resorted to this, and of course this is why we are facing this crisis today. But it also serves those interests who like to think that we have this responsibility. They claim it's a moral responsibility to take our young people, put them into the military, and send them hither and yon around the world, policing the world and using up our money. So just as we have been able to bring to the forefront that most important issue of funny money, fiat money, the paper money system, the Federal Reserve, we have brought to the forefront. Others have tokenly talked about it. They get in office and they do nothing about it. But right now, it is this liberty movement, which is seen as a patriotic movement, an individual liberty movement, that is saying to the country and to the world, we've had enough of sending our kids and our money around the world to be the policemen of the world. It's the time to bring them home. We do know they will come home. My goal and our goal has always been to bring them home in a deliberate fashion, to avoid major economic crisis by destroying our economy by spending so much overseas. In the last 10 years, the wars that have gone on added $4 trillion of debt. And I don't think we have been one bit safer for it. I think we have been less safe because of all the money that we have spent overseas. So this is the issue now. It is an issue that I think is crucial. Jim mentioned in the introduction that, you know, so often they say that if we tell people that we think we should spend less in the military, they say, oh, that means you want to cut defense. No, if you cut the military-industrial complex, you cut war profiteering, but you don't take one penny out of national defense. And besides, we're flat out broke. Fortunately, we did not have to fight the Soviets. The Soviets brought themselves down for economic reasons. Do you know that they were so foolish and thought themselves so bold that they could pursue their world empire that they invaded Afghanistan? But we will come home, but if we do it now calmly and deliberately, we can save our economy here at home. because there are a lot of people who are suffering here at home. You have to stop the inflation because that's what destroys the middle class, and that's what transfers the wealth from the poor and the middle class to the wealthy. And that is why the wealthy got their bailouts and the middle class shrunk and they lost their jobs and they lost their houses. So this is what we have to do. We have to cut the spending. This is why I have made a token suggestion in the first year of office. We would cut at least $1 trillion from the budget. Now, the one thing that the talk you hear in Washington is pure talk because there is nobody suggesting, the other candidates are not talking about real cuts. They're talking about cutting proposed increases out in 10 years. They say, oh, we'll cut $1 trillion. Yeah, $1 trillion over a 10-year period, which is $100 billion every year. Our national debt is going up in real terms $100 billion every month, and they claim that's cutting, and they're yelling and screaming, oh, we can't cut, we can't cut. We do have to cut. We have to live within our means if we want to be able to at least take care of the people who have been made to be so dependent on the government. I mean, we have to work our way out. I would say if we did this and cut this overseas spending, at least we might be able to allow the Social Security beneficiaries to get their checks and medical care be provided. But if we continue to do what we're doing, the results are that the dollar is destroyed, and the whole thing comes apart, and it's going to be a worldwide phenomenon. Already, Social Security beneficiaries are suffering a lot. Their income is shrinking because the value of the dollar is going down, so they're getting their checks cut. And that is why you have to think about the cutting and the stopping the inflation. But overall, you have to ask, once again, as our founders did, what should the role of government be in a free society? The role should be very simple, the protection of liberty. You know, the Constitution was written for a very precise manner. It was not designed to restrain the individual, not to restrain you. It was to protect your liberties and to restrain the federal government. But liberty has to be reemphasized because we have been careless over the last 100 years. We have taken liberty and chopped it up into pieces. Some people think liberty has to do with personal habits, which I agree. Other people think liberty is how to spend your money, and they defend that part, and then they fight about when to do what. I think what we need to do is make this emphasis that liberty means you have a right to your life and your privacy and the way you want to live your life as long as you don't hurt people, and you have a right to keep and spend your money as you want to. But freedom is a wonderful idea, and that's why I get so excited, but I really get excited when I see young people saying it is a wonderful idea. Freedom is popular, don't you know that? Freedom brings people together. I think it's magnificent that the crowds that have come out over the weeks and months have been very diverse, because it should be, because some people want their freedom to practice their religious in one way, or maybe another way. Some might not even want to practice it at all. But freedom, if you understand it, you should all fight for freedom because you want to exert your freedom the way you want. Same way with economic freedom. It should bring people together. And I think this is one reason people worry about how are you ever going to put in a coalition, or how are you going to, oh, no, they don't want a coalition. They said, how are you going to compromise and give up some of your beliefs in order to get some things passed? You don't have to compromise. What you have to do is emphasize the coalitions that people want their freedoms for a different reason and bring them together. America has been the greatest country ever, the most prosperous country ever, the largest middle class ever. It's not that way today. Our middle class is shrinking. The country is getting poorer. The wealth is apparent is based on debt. the few who really hold the wealth. It's maldistribution because it shifts over due to the regulations that control a government. We have had too many people too long in the last 100 years thinking that it was beneficial more to be have high-paid lobbyists to get them to find out what they can get from the government, rather than us petitioning our government in a proper manner, to petitioning our government and demanding our freedoms back again. A lot of times they give us trouble, and they say, freedom, you people are just too selfish. All you want to do is have your freedom, you know, and they argue that that is the case. But the thing of it is, the people, the bleeding hearts, and I understand them, and I recognize them, and I believe most of them are well intended. But it doesn't work. It's the problem. All that good intentions of saying we're going to give everybody a free house and no loans, and then they can borrow against, you know, the equity. And look what happened. It was a bubble. It burst, and they lost their houses. So the humanitarian instincts are there across the board. What we have to convince them, if you are a true humanitarian, you have to fight and argue the case for free markets, sound money, property rights, contract rights, no use of force, and a sensible foreign policy so we don't waste our resources. We're well on our way. People have asked me, what did I expect 5, 10 years ago? I had no idea. I always assumed that the best I could do is set a record. I didn't know you were out there. It's no longer that irate, tireless minority that is stirring up the troops. Now that irate minority, and so tireless as you have been, it's growing by leaps and bounds. It's going to continue to grow by leaps and bounds, and we will restore freedom to this country. Thank you very much.
Like I was just mentioning to Lila, I had sent...
If I had asked you to do that earlier on today.
You did?
Yeah, I said go into the Ron Paul website and ask what this means.
Oh, you mean after I told you about it?
Yeah.
But I had already sent... I sent a letter to...
an email.
An email to them and asked if they would respond to that.
To that quote that we read.
And so far they haven't responded yet. But...
because that acceptance speech certainly doesn't reflect that 2001
not at all. And that's what's really, really kind of strange.
It's kind of troubling.
And I've got another couple of things here that I wanted to talk about tonight. I wanted to show you this one. Dennis Kucinich, that one's irrelevant, basically, but... Democrats abandoned Obama for Ron Paul.
Oh, that's interesting.
I thought this was an interesting one. Ron Paul is America's leading voice for limited constitutional government, low taxes, free markets, sound money, and a pro-American foreign policy. But, again, you know, if you look at our opening statement...
In light of that opening statement, that doesn't seem correct.
Exactly.
It seems some Democrats are finally waking up to the fact that President Obama is, in many ways... running a third term for President George W. Bush.
Yeah.
President Obama's continuation of Bush-era policies such as hostile drone war in the Middle East,
yeah,
intervention in Libya, and his blatant crony capitalism in the case of Solyndra is actually forcing some Democrats to abandon their party. And some of them have found their candidate. Joining me now is the former chair of the Belknap County, New Hampshire Democrats, Lynn Chong. Is registered now as an independent in New Hampshire. Lynn, it's a pleasure. Welcome to Freedom Watch.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You are a Democrat. Thank you. You are a Democrat. You are the former county chair of Belknap County. You abandoned your own party and became an independent. Why did you do this?
I decided to do this in August because I could see that it's really important what Republican gets sent out of New Hampshire during the primary. our January 10th primary date is set now and coming up. And I thought, I've got to have a hand in this. I want someone who will really challenge President Obama. And for me, that's Ron Paul.
Why do you, a Democrat and a former leader of Democrats, have you decided that Ron Paul is the president we need?
Because Ron Paul is very frank and honest. I saw him this week, Wednesday night in Portsmouth, and last night in Laconia. He's not an afraid person at all. He's not hedging his bets. He says what he believes, and I think we would not see any kind of, tit-for-tat, quiet, I won't touch this topic, I won't touch that topic if you don't, kind of deal, tacit or otherwise, between him and Obama when we have Ron Paul as a presidential candidate facing off with Obama during debates. I think during the time of Clinton and H.W. Bush, neither of them talked about Nicaragua. Each one had some part in that Oliver North.
Let me ask you this. Why have you, a lifelong Democrat, rejected the reelection and the continued presidency of Barack Obama?
Well, you just said it for me. You voiced what I've been saying to friends for a while now. It's like having a third candidacy, a third Bush Cheney set of years. He's got the same energy policy. He's got the same wars going. He's got Guantanamo going. Oil policy is not changed a bit. I just don't see that he at all, if anything, he's gone the opposite direction from
the
changes he promised.
Okay, let me ask you this. You participated in one of the Occupy Wall Street gatherings, I think, in Washington, D.C. Did you find other Ron Paul supporters there?
I did. I ran into a clutch of young people in their 20s carrying Ron Paul signs, and I said to them, "Are you really for Ron Paul?" And they said, "Yes." And we were there at the anniversary, the 10th year anniversary of the Afghanistan war starting October 4th. So a lot of us had come there because we are anti-war. We want the wars to stop. We want the troops brought home. Those young people also wanted Ron Paul as president.
Got it. Last question to you, Lynn. How have your fellow Democrats reacted to your desertion of your lifelong party in order to vote for Ron Paul?
It's a good question. I've had lots of people say to me, "What are you doing?" Because they question his social policies. And I say top of the pile for concerns for me is stopping war.
Got it.
And Ron Paul last night said, we need to practice the golden rule when we're abroad.
Got it.
We
Lynn Chung, it's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Entry.
Thanks very much
Thank
for joining
you.
Us. Good luck to you.
Okay.
Are your rights
Thank
the government?
So I found that to be interesting. Because
she's anti-war, and that's why she voted for Barack Obama.
Exactly.
Thinking, he didn't really mislead people, because he's voted for every war that he could possibly vote for and increased all of the spending. But people were led to believe that he was
That's right. He even said he was going to end the war. That was the first thing he said.
What he said was he was going to end the war in Iraq and he was going to move it to Afghanistan, which is what he did.
Right. Well, whatever he said.
People didn't hear that second part.
I have a speech that he actually said that. That he actually said he was going to end the war, and where he said it, right? But then, as soon as he got in,
he made no secret of expanding it to Iraq, to Afghanistan.
Well, regardless of what you're saying, I know because I saw the speech, and they did say that he was going to end it as soon as he got elected. That would be the first thing he would do, right? Which was the last thing he did, I spent quite a bit of time on Ron Paul because it's such an issue, and I'm quite fascinated by the character himself. But at the same time, another interesting thing came up, and another interesting thing about his racism, all right?
And that's another part of his past that troubles me.
Yeah, but if you look at what he said and what he's really been saying,
and how it's being
all along, you got to wonder about this guy because he really does not do anything that he really has not said anything. In many, many years that even comes close to racism. And I'd like to play this last speech on this because I really think it's...
What year was that?
It's a compilation of different things that he said on the Senate floor, on the House floor, all right? And I think you'll be surprised. He's been very, very...
I would like to believe that if we have a freer society, it will take care of blacks and whites and everybody equally, because we're all individuals, and to me that is so important. But if we had equal justice under the law, I think it would be a big improvement. If we had probably a repeal of most of the federal laws on drugs and the unfairness on how blacks are treated with these drug laws, it would be a tremendous improvement. Congressman Paul.
I agree with you.
A system designed to protect individual liberty will have no punishments for any group and no privileges. Today, I think inner city folks and minorities are punished unfairly in the war on drugs. For instance, blacks make up 14% of those who use drugs, yet 36% of those arrested are blacks, and it ends up that 63% of those who finally end up in prison are blacks. This has to change. We don't have to have more courts and more prisons. We need to repeal the whole war on drugs. It isn't working. We have already spent over $400 billion since the early 70s, and it's a wasted money. Prohibition didn't work. Prohibition on drugs doesn't work. So we need to come to our senses, and absolutely, it's a disease. We don't treat alcoholics like this. This is a disease, and we should orient ourselves to this. That is one way you could have equal justice under the law.
Thank you, Congressman. The next question will be asked.
Congressman, Paul's support has gradually been slipping for the death penalty among all Americans. The Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life reports a large majority of whites still support capital punishment, while blacks and Latinos do not. Now, I know this is mostly a state function, but the president does appoint appellate judges and, of course, the highest appellate judges in the land, the Supreme Court justices who often review death penalty cases. Do you think the death penalty is carried out justly in the United States? And do you want to see it continued during your presidency?
30 seconds, Congressman.
You know, over the years, I've held pretty rigid all my beliefs, but I've changed my opinion about the death penalty. For federal purposes, I no longer believe in the death penalty. I believe it has been issued unjustly. If you're rich, you get away with it. If you're poor and you're from the inner city, you're more likely to be prosecuted and convicted. And today, with the DNA evidence, there's been too many mistakes, so I am now opposed to the federal death penalty.
Thank you, Constance. Senator Brownback.
I'm not a racist. Matter of fact, Rosa Parks is one of my heroes. Martin Luther King is a hero because they practice the libertarian principle of civil disobedience, nonviolence. Libertarians are incapable of being a racist because racism is a collectivist idea. You see people in groups. A civil libertarian like myself see everybody as an important individual. It's not the color of the skin that is important, as Martin Luther King said. What is important is the character of the individual. You know what is really interesting, though, and this might be behind it, because I, as a Republican candidate, probably am getting the most number of black votes and black supporters, and now that has to be undermined. And I do this because I attack two wars that blacks are suffering from. One, the war overseas. In all wars, minorities suffer the most, so they join me in this position I have against the war in Iraq. And what about the war on drugs? What other candidate will stand up and spray in the can and say, I would pardon all blacks, all whites, everybody who are convicted for nonviolent drug acts and drug crimes? And this is where the real discrimination is. Let me finish this because I got to get my message back because you put the other message out. Now, if you want to look for discrimination, it's in the judicial system. 14% of the inner city blacks commit drug crime. 67% of blacks are in prison. That's discrimination. That's the judicial code that I am attacking, and that is not racism. What I defend is the principle of libertarianism, where we never see people who belong to a group, and every individual is defended and protected because they're important in the individual, not because of their color of skin, but of their character. So I am the anti-racist because I am the only candidate, Republican or Democrat, who would protect the minority against these vicious drug laws.
So, so much on his racist policies. I think he, I think he's right.
I agree with him 100% on everything he said.
I did too. And it's like, you know, there's so much to agree with here with him. But at the same time, you're posed with that first question that we brought about, which was, you know, if there is nothing to fear from globalism, free trade and single world currency. I mean, those were his exact words.
But you don't know whether what the context of that speech
was.
Well,
regardless of the context of the speech,
he didn't say
that sentence in itself.
Doesn't say he was for it. He said there was nothing to fear.
There's nothing to fear from globalism.
He didn't say he supported it, Leo.
It's the same thing.
No, it is not the same thing.
Well, let's go back to that statement.
You don't know the context.
Let's go back to that statement.
He doesn't say I support.
He says, there's nothing to fear from globalism, free trade, and single world currency. These are the three things that he has denounced. Free trade, he denounced that, okay? Before, he denounced globalism and he denounced the single, you know, one world government. Okay, and the effort in recent decades to unify government surveillance over all world trade, international financial transactions through the UN, IMF, World Bank, WTO, ICC, and OECD, and the Bank of International Settlements can never substitute for a peaceful world based on a true free trade. Now, a true free trade, freedom of movement, a single but sound market currency, and voluntary contracts with private property rights. But then he says the ultimate solution will only come with the rejection of fiat money worldwide and a restoration of commodity money. So that would be like gold, all right? Mm-hmm. Commodity money, if voluntarily and universally accepted, could give us a single world currency requiring no money managers, no manipulators orchestrating a man-made business cycle with rampant price inflation.
Well, we need him to explain that.
That has to be explained, you know, because if it's not, it just blatantly states that he's, you know.
Well, we need more explanation on that.
Well, I sent to his campaign a request to explain that quote, okay?
And we'll
see if we hear anything from it, that's all.
Then we'll bring it to you.
Yeah, we'll bring it to you in a future show, all right? If that,
we'll definitely save that quote, and we'll see what he has to say.
Oh, absolutely. And
because I like all of the other things that he has to say.
Oh, I did too. I really did too.
I'm really thinking seriously about voting for him.
So, and this is what brought me to the conclusion that, or this thing. And when I saw this tonight, I was going, wow.
If he can make it, I don't know whether he'll make it.
We don't know. But nevertheless.
So there are lots of Democrats that switched over, I guess.
We had Larry Dorman on last night from the AFSCME Union, and AFSCME has been a major, major supporter
Of Obama.
Well, yeah, but I was going to introduce this article. The major advocate against Governor Walker, okay, in Wisconsin. And
they've been fighting him.
And what happened is now is Governor Walker was accused of over 1,000 violations of campaign finance law, okay, and could face $557,000 worth of fines.
Which is probably nothing to him.
Well, nevertheless, I mean, you know, personally, it's a lot of dough, you know.
His corporate supporters will pay it for him.
Probably, but nevertheless, let's consider what happened here, okay? And you got to remember that recall is still in process. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker may have violated his state's campaign finance law over 1,000 times. In the 2010 gubernatorial campaign by failing to properly report contributions, according to a new report.
He couldn't say, whoops, I forgot.
Yeah, right. And Wisconsin law requires gubernatorial campaigns to disclose information about contributors who give more than $100. Again and again, Walker appears to have skirted that requirement. One Wisconsin now examined the Walker for governor finance records and found 1,115 instances where the campaign received contributions of more than $100, but did not properly disclose who gave the money. In total, Walker was improperly reported well over $500,000 in contributions from inside and outside of Wisconsin, said Scott Ross, one Wisconsin Now executive director. According to the group, which has filed a complaint with the State Government Accountability Board, Walker's violations could result in fines of $557,500. The reporting statutes were enacted to give the public a full and timely picture of who is contributing to political candidates and the interest they may be representing. Lawmakers felt that this was particularly important in the days preceding a general or primary election. According to the statutes, each violation of the reporting laws can result in fines of up to $500, which in Walker's case could top nearly $557,500. And Sithink Progress, which is the group that wrote this article, reached out to the Walker campaign for comment, but had not heard back by publication time. We will provide an update of the response to the change. So,
it's a response to the charge.
Charger, I'm sorry. Yeah. So, interesting. What do you think of that?
Yeah.
I thought that was...
Just he wasn't paying attention.
I guess not. And I got two more articles here, which was kind of funny. One is 300 Chinese Foxconn workers threatened mass suicide at Xbox plant. Okay, and let's go to that right now.
The thought of Xbox is driving them over the edge?
No, they're actually workers who make the Xbox. That's a Bill Gates product.
Right, I realize that.
Yeah, the Game Boy, you know. But kind of interesting.
Well, they probably work under horrible conditions.
Yeah. So, let's see what we got here.
Close that.
Try. There you go.
300 Chinese Foxconn workers threatened mass suicide at Xbox plant, reports claim. Around 300 workers who manufacture Xbox consoles took to a factory roof and threatened bosses with mass suicide over a dispute about pay, unconfirmed reports have claimed. The workers were employed at the Foxconn Technology Park in Wuhan in Hubei Province. Foxconn is an independent global manufacturing partner to companies including Apple, Microsoft, and Sony. Microsoft said Wednesday that it is investigating the incident. According to unverified reports emerging from an anti-government Chinese news website, about 300 workers took to the roof of the Taiwanese-owned factory on the 2nd of January to protest against their employers. Those reports have since been repealed by websites repeated by websites including Kotaku, but neither Foxconn or Microsoft has yet confirmed the incident took place. According to the reports, the employees had asked bosses for a raise, but in response were told to either quit with compensation or keep their jobs at their usual salary. Most workers apparently decided to leave, but the company did not hand over the money as promised. According to the China Jasmine Revolution website, the workers were only dissuaded a day later when the mayor of Wuhan talked them out of committing suicide. Foxconn factories in China have been the scene of several suicides by workers in the past, including 14 in 2010 alone at the Shenzhen plant after complaints of low pay and poor conditions. That's disgusting.
So people, I mean, these guys are actually committing suicide.
So you can imagine how horrible the conditions are.
Can you imagine that? I mean, we go on strike in this country, but, you know, sometimes.
Yeah.
But, I mean, to actually, you know, threaten to commit suicide is pretty bizarre. But
obviously they didn't care because they let them go without compensation. They didn't care.
Yeah, they didn't care. Well, anyway. This is, there's been so many studies coming up recently on cannabis, and this one in particular just came up today that I noticed, and it was cannabis and osteoporosis. Yeah.
Mm.
is a osteoporosis is a degenerative skeletal disease.
Bone disease.
Yeah. Characterized by a deterioration of bone tissue. Patients with osteoporosis are at risk for suffering multiple fractures and other serious disabilities.
That's why it's women or men who fall in later life, it's very difficult to heal because of the osteoporosis.
Approximately
it's
10
prevalent
million
in a lot of the elderly.
Approximately 10 million Americans over age 50 suffer from osteoporosis, according to the U.S. Surgeon General. And I'm going to go to this article. Because cannabis actually helps. Where am I here?
Osteoporosis is a degenerative skeletal disease characterized by deterioration of bone tissue. Patients with osteoporosis are at risk for suffering multiple fractures and other serious disabilities. So approximately 10 million Americans over 50 suffer from osteoporosis. I didn't think that many. According to the U.S. Surgeon General. Initial references regarding the potential use of...
And another 34 million are at risk from developing the disease.
Yeah.
Okay.
Initial references regarding the potential use of cannabinoids to protect against the onset of osteoporosis are available in the scientific literature beginning in the early 1990s. To date, however, no clinical work has taken place investigating the use of cannabis for this indication. Writing in the January 2006 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, investigators at the Bone Laboratory of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem reported that the administration of the synthetic cannabis,
cannabinoid,
Angonis HU308, slowed the development of osteoporosis, stimulated bone building, and reduced bone loss in animals. Follow-up research published in the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences in 2007 reported that the activation of the CB2 cannabinoid receptor reduced experimentally induced bone loss and stimulated bone formation. So, okay, so they...
Investigators previously reported that the mice deficient in the CB2 cannabinoid receptor experienced age-accelerated bone loss reminiscent of human osteoporosis. And scientists now speculate that the main physiologic involvement of specific endocannabinoid receptors is to maintain bone remodeling at balance, thus protecting the skeleton against age-related bone loss, and leading some experts to believe that cannabinoids may be a promising target, novel target of for anti-osteoporotic drug development, which is really something else. I think that's tremendous. You know, that they're finally accepting the fact that you know, cannabis has tremendous health benefits. You know, so anyway. But that's basically what we were talking about tonight. There's a couple other things I wanted to bring up before we end tonight. I think we already did this.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, hang on a second. I'm going to go to... The Ron Paul issue just knocked me out. I don't know. As much as I like this guy, there's certain things that are coming that, you know, just make me question.
Crazy.
Yeah, you know, make me wonder, is this guy as good as he sounds, you know? And, I mean, he wants to cut $1 trillion. The first year he's president, he wants to cut $1 trillion out of the budget right away, you know? Where the hell is that going to come from?
Foreign aid. And armies and all that kind of
foreign
thing.
Foreign aid, the armed military, but he's also talking about, you know...
He said he wouldn't cut Social Security and Medicare.
He
just
that
he
didn't feel he could do that.
No.
You know, that there was no
there
way...
Too many... Well, there were people
too
that are...
Too many already, people submit, dependent upon
well,
it.
Well, they paid know. Into it. They deserve to have that back.
Yes, absolutely. And...
Oh, this is... the Tavistock Institute for Global Manipulation.
Yeah, we've talked about this before and how they're behind a lot of things. My own doubts came when DDT was introduced in Guyana within 2 years. It had almost eliminated malaria. So my chief quarrel with DDT in hindsight is that it had greedy...
Something.
It has greatly added to the population problem of our own founder, Alexander King. I don't know, you want to see something?
Yeah, see what that is.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know what the Tavistock Institute for Global Manipulation is, Tavistock Institute is in London, all right? And they were behind many of the mass movements, the LSD movement, the Beatlemania, the, you know.
They do, did a lot of
things.
Experiments on mind control.
Exactly.
And they, that's where it came out of.
Yeah. Oh, look, you thought that was interesting, too.
Ron Paul's
fantastic
speech after what?
After he won. That's the one we just put.
Yeah, somebody else thought it was good, yeah.
So anyway, let's check this one out. On the Tavistock thing.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. This is on the Tavistock. Science of Mass Manipulation and Crisis Creation, an introduction to the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations. In our dreams, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. Frederick Gates, chairman of the Rockefeller Established General Education Board. I hope this is all pictures of real.
Created Oxford in 1921 by the Royal Institute of International Affairs with later funding from the Rockefeller Foundation, the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations is the nerve center for the global manipulation of human consciousness. That's true. I've heard a lot of their things that they've done in psychology. Not long after Tavistock was set up by co-founder John Rawlings Reed and others, it became the core of Britain's Psychological Warfare Bureau, studying the effects of shell shock on British soldiers.
Everybody's related to Rawlings, the author there.
Tavistock also played a crucial role in the creation of the OSS, the precursor of the CIA, under the guidance of Dr. Kurt Lewin, with help from Alan Dulles, the German Nazis, and the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. Research into the use of microwave weapons and the use for mind control began in the 1950s at Tavistock. The UK Institute was researching into ways of mind controlling the British population without them knowing. Aside from helping to create the CIA, Tavistock was also the major force behind the formation of NATO and is deeply connected to the Club of Rome. Executives are drawn from NATO and are the primary policy makers for the organization. Alexander King, Club of Rome co-founder. My own doubts came when DDT was introduced. In Guyana, within 2 years, it had almost eliminated malaria. So my chief quarrel with DDT in hindsight is that it had greatly added to the population problem. Club of Rome co-founder, Alexander King. Works with Tavistock to create propaganda and crisis in order to manipulate the world's population in a predetermined direction toward a collectivism, one-world socialistic dictatorship.
pioneered the concept of deprogramming an individual of their traditional beliefs through trauma to allow for reprogramming according to the controller's wishes. This would become the origin for the concept of future shock, written about and popularized by Alan Troffler in his book, the title. This concept was presented by Troffler as being a spontaneous occurrence, when in fact the exact opposite is true.
Future Shock by Alvin Troffler.
Right.
Today, Tavistock operates through a vast network of think tanks, the NGOs, universities, and media outlets to influence public opinion while breaking down the moral fabric that has held the West together using scientifically created techniques of manipulation, like video games.
Uh-huh. And Wharton University are all part of it.
Tavistock has played an important role in the creation of several institutional centers, including Stanford Research Institute, the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and the Sloan School at MIT.
Wharton School is the big one that Donald Trump graduated from. University of Pennsylvania.
Other groups that work closely with Tavistock include the Heritage Foundation, the Rand Corporation, the Hudson Institute, Esalen, Brookings Institution, MIT, Institute for Policy Studies, and Walden Research.
So these are all major think tanks.
MIT, one of Tavistock's largest U.S. institutions, in turn works through several clients, including NASA, U.S. Navy and Army, Treasury, Department of State, National Council of Churches, National Academy of Sciences, and Sylvania.
Like the TV sets.
Important role Tavistock has played in the corporate world via the National Training Laboratories is the sponsoring of group sensitivity and diversity programs designed to erase a person's individuality so that they become a team player. The fact is that political correctness is all about creating uniformity. Individualism is one of the biggest obstacles in the way of the New World Order. They want a public that is predictable and conditioned to do it as it's told without asking questions.
See, this is where Ron Paul's liberty, individualism, all this stuff flies in the face of all this globalism.
Yeah, so that's what we have to.
It's really
an important question. The fact is, we read that. Tavistock portrays itself as a non-political, non-governmental organization, but this is simply not the case when you look how deeply entrenched it is with governments and organizations connected to government, both here in the U.S. and abroad. This video serves as only a brief introduction to the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations and the influence it has over the governments of the world via the transnational corporations, NGOs, intelligence agencies, media, and universities. Okay.
So that's it.
And we've come to the end of our show.
Yeah.
So we thank you for listening to us, and we hope you have a good evening and think about some of the things we've said.
Yeah, we hope you do. And let's see if we can get, of course.
You want to say goodnight?
Oh, yes.
I don't know.
Crashing.
Oh, there you go.
Can you
say goodnight?
Yeah, well, I will. I just wanted to go to my studio here so that we could get the songs and stuff. There we go. All right, I don't know what happened. happened there. We kind of had another fade out of our program.
So put your music on.
So anyway, we hope you enjoyed the show, and hope you join us again tomorrow, and question this whole Ron Paul thing like we are. And if we get a response from the Ron Paul campaign,
we'll certainly read it to you.
We will read it to you. Okay. So good luck, and hope to see you tomorrow night.